Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Last Friday, the U.S. intelligence community released its declassified report into what it calls the influence campaign to harm Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton's chances of winning the presidency. The report stated with high confidence that Russia's interference, including the hacking of Democratic groups and individuals' computer accounts, was designed to undermine faith in the U.S. democratic process. It was ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin himself and assessed his motives in doing so, and was multifaceted, involving state-funded media, third parties, and paid social media users to influence the election. Well, just before this report was released, I spoke with University of Tulsa communication professor Benjamin Peters about the Russian hacking and about his work examining the history of Russian communication. He's the author of a book that looks back at the old Soviet Union's efforts to create an internet back in the 1960s and 70s, at roughly the same time as ARPANET, the precursor to what we now know as the internet. It's titled How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. It's published by MIT Press. I spoke with him about the book, as well as the fallout from the hacking campaign by the Russian government. Benjamin Peters, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thrilled.
I imagine it's a pretty interesting thing when this topic you've been working on for the last probably 5, 6, 7 years, you know, all of a sudden becomes an ancillary news event with all this Russian hacking. Before we talk about your book, what are your thoughts on this whole thought of, certainly security services are always trying to influence other governments. What do you think of what's going on with this idea of Russian government-backed hacking into trying to influence the election?
As a Russian specialist and a media scholar, I've spent some time thinking about this for a while. And I think I am upset, for sure. But I think I would call for us to kind of caution or curb our outrage, or at least to contextualize it. I mean, imagine for a moment that you were born a citizen of Japan or the Philippines or Guatemala or Chile or Congo or Iran or something. And I can imagine looking at the America now and saying to the Americans, oh, America, you had a foreign power interfere with your democratic process. Oh, I'm so sorry. Right? I mean, the point is that whoever is doing this is clearly emulating our state and a long U.S. tradition of meddling in and monkeying with the political integrity of really countless countries around the world. And I think that's not to say that it's by any means okay, but rather to say that as citizens, we should try to develop a mature, kind of informed conscience about what nation states have been doing to one another for a long time. And that same conscience, I think, can help us steel and prepare and be more sensitive to what our country might do in the future.
Given everything that's happened in this last election cycle, it's almost like you have to become a very careful consumer of anything you see on the internet or even in any sort of media now.
Precisely. And that's the second thing, is this care. The internet promised sort of the democratic flourishing of all conversations, but what we've encountered are increasingly number of kind of fringe conspiracies. And I think there's a lot that we can check. The Russian hacking situation is a perfect example of at least two conspiracies that I think we ought to be able to draw back. We do know a couple things. We know, for example, there's an FSB-associated hacking group by the name of Prikolny Medved, or Fancy Bear, that has attacked the DNC, and it seems to have bolstered about 7,000 pro-Trump Twitter accounts. But we know a lot more, right? We know they've also attacked the German parliament, the French TV, some Dutch, the Ukrainians, NATO. This is, unfortunately, kind of par for the course.
It's a byproduct of the information age, right?
Yes, a byproduct of the information age. This is the capital that we are now turning on. But there's another way of saying this is we should be outraged and upset that 80% of pro-Trump Twitter activity is artificial. But we should also recognize that about 50% of all major politicians' Twitter activity is artificial too. So this is the new normal is shifting.
What do you mean by artificial? That it's
Robots retweeting. There's no person there. There's troll farms that are bought out in Eastern Europe to create fake news sites and to push pro-Trump and pro-Clinton or pro-anybody agendas. And here I think the point is, once you've recognized that, not to be outraged at that, but rather to recognize that our responsibility as citizens is now heightened. We are The call is something like this. We bear the burden for reading and circulating and entertaining fake news. Of course, there's going to be a hacker who can be bought to create some artificial tool to distort and disturb the media environment. But we are responsible as media literate or illiterate citizens for what we do in that environment.
How much do you think the idea that this is only a short idea in American political thought, but there was this time when news was thought to be fairly neutral, right, and that if it was news, it was, you know, it was going to be as objective as possible. This really goes back to the beginning of mass communication with radio and television in the early days. When you think back to the 1880s, when it was mainly newspaper, it was almost totally newspapers. Every newspaper had the bias of the guy who owned it. And a consumer would naturally be wary about anything they read from a source they did not necessarily trust.
Precisely.
Maybe, I mean, are we going to go back to that age with this sort of information age sort of
That's
chaos?
A great question. And maybe it's in a weird way healthy that we're reentering the yellow journalism age of the information age, right? That we're now recognizing that bias is on every sleeve, even if we don't haven't always seen those sleeves, right? No, I think that's a great point. In many ways, the myth of objectivity in the news cycle has not insulated us from the obvious biases that maybe have always been around us and that we're now seeing so clearly. No, I think that's right. In many ways, objectivity, I think, has done us a disservice because we've believed in it and trusted in it too much.
Now, when we see that, you know, the FSB-backed site that is definitely hacked the DNC, and we'll probably learn more details as they go on, as the election sort of fades into the rearview mirror. What should the United States do if we find out that this was certainly organized from the very highest levels of the Russian government? Is it something we can really do a whole lot about? I don't know that we really can do except sanctions or keeping a distant relationship. And who knows if that's going to be the case with the new administration?
I don't know the answer. I would suggest as a moment of comfort that I think we do, no matter who's in the White House or whatever our concerns at the top level, America has a strong and civilized civil service class, a deep bench of people who understand and follow these things carefully. And I don't want to trust in that institution too much, but I do think on balance that our responses will be politics as normal in many ways. And so we need not worry too much. We'll manage the relation somehow as a government. But I think as citizens, there's still another question. And you so wonderfully pointed out this word hacking doesn't quite feel right for what's going on. And maybe that's because it's time to revise our image of what a hacker is. You know, basically, in one word, read Gabriella Coleman, who's a wonderful anthropologist of hacking, and who describes a class of technical experts as almost as diverse as computer users themselves, politically, economically, even gender. You know, aesthetically, they're all committed to cleverness, it seems. But in Malaysia, there's more women computer users than men. So there's lots of excitement and new ways to revise our vision. I think no longer can we imagine the hacker as the, you know, adolescent male typing quickly in some darkened basement somewhere. And by the way, that male is always either too large or too small. It's as if we're uncomfortable allowing men to be physically fit and also technically expert.
Right, right.
Yeah, President-elect Trump once, you know, actually twice in the last month has made references to this. I think the point is that we're all involved in a far broader class of technical computer manipulation, one way or the other. And we need to normalize that and understand it and form it a little bit more with a broader sense of it's not just one stereotype anymore, but this is everybody.
But, you know, it's interesting that when you look at what the primary public charge of the hacking is, it's that they went into the DNC, they made public private emails from the DNC and from people in the Clinton campaign. Now, if you take that to another era, say 40 years ago or 50 years ago, and you, as a journalist, obtain documents from, say, the DNC or the RNC or a presidential campaign, and you release them as journalistic stories, you would be called a heroic journalist. You know, you might, you know, especially if it was exposing wrongdoing of some sort, that's hacking too, but it's hacking in a right. paper age as opposed to an information
right.
age.
Investigative journalism is a form of hacking, right? Whistleblowing is a form of hacking. Mm-hmm. We have a proud and deep American tradition of disclosure that is another word for hacking in some sense. And I think that ought to be normalized. We need to recognize that hackers are not only breaking into and stealing stuff, they're also printing and securitizing, as well as just playing with stuff. I think that's precisely right. That there's deep moral as well as amoral traditions behind this word we call hacking.
My guest today is Benjamin Peters. He's assistant professor of communications at the University of Tulsa and also involved with the Information Society Project at Yale University. He's also the author of the book, How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. It's published by MIT Press. So you use the term Soviet Internet, which you talk about in your introduction of the book. And it says, you know, given that the Internet became popular only after the fall of the Soviet Union, and we think of everything about the Internet as being antithetical to everything we understand about the Soviet regime, what was the Soviet Internet?
So I think the conventional wisdom is that we associate the Internet with everything that's democratic and distributed. It's a vehicle for bringing about liberty and commerce and democracy. And usually the kind of stereotype of the Soviet Union is precisely the opposite. Cumbersome, lumbering hierarchy, over-centralized hierarchy that did many terrible things. And there's some truth to both stereotypes, of course. What I mean by the Soviet Internet is, in fact, a very ambitious attempt that actually was tried over a period of about 30 years, 1959 to the mid-1980s, to build a civilian nationwide computer network for the Soviet citizens. And this attempt, it took many names. The biggest one that I chronicle in the book is called the OGOS, spearheaded by a man named Viktor Mikhailovich Glushkov. The OGOS was, in some ways, a technological update for the command economy, a way of saying, let's apply computer networks to the many bureaucratic information flows of the command economy and see if we can't streamline and make efficient this grand socialist economic project with computer networks. Yeah, a digital update for the command economy, as it were.
And you say this began in 1959. Does that actually predate ARPANET?
As best as I can tell, and I'm careful in the book to caution against adhering too closely to firsts questions in the Cold War horse race. Mm-hmm. But as best as I can tell, this was developed independently as well as before the ARPANET originators.
Now, as if I remember right, there was you referenced a CIA report in about 1962 where a CIA report suggested that the Soviets were beginning to put something like this, like what would be an internet, together.
Yeah.
Was that a spur at all to the United States?
You know, it was.
I would imagine it had to be. You have to think of this is in terms of the space race. I mean, we're competing with the Soviets on everything.
Yeah, right. And we should remind ourselves that the Soviets have all the mathematics and the might and the motivation to, you know, carry out a grand technological project. And they do it in lots of spaces, the nuclear race, the space race, mathematics, logic and physics and lots of science. It's a science superpower. There's no a priori reason they couldn't have pulled some of this off, at least technologically. And that's the way in. In fact, I should note that 1962 report was a spur for me personally. I was looking for a dissertation project back in 2007 in my PhD program at Columbia, and I stumbled upon this footnote of a recently declassified report where there was a CIA Russia specialist wringing their hands about the Soviets developing what they called, quote, a unified information net. And this was in 1962. And I thought, oh my gosh, of course the Soviets were trying to do something like that. They've got all the cybernetics in the world. They've got all the other things I mentioned. Why don't I know this story? Why don't we know this story? It's the contemporary of the ARPANET, which is the predecessor to our internet today.
Yeah. And in Glushkov's case, it's interesting that you write, it says, you know, ARPANET was formed by a group of capitalists who acted with a sort of collective weight of sharing everything collectively and a sort of a communistic model to develop what became the internet. The Russians took the opposite approach. Here it was a socialist society that tried to develop in a capitalist sort of way, where everybody was competing with one another.
That's precisely the uneasy reversal with which I begin the book. I say the first global computer networks developed thanks to capitalists behaving like socialists, not socialists behaving like capitalists. Or in other words, that the ARPANET took shape at the height of the Defense Department. It was its top dog research agency with lots of Congress-directed state funding to build a space for research collaboration and sharing. And now you shift over and look at the Russian situation or the Soviet situation, and you find decades of institutional infighting and bureaucratic, sometimes corruption, sometimes just kind of beleaguered infighting, and a kind of tragedy of unregulated competition among institutions and bureaucrats that kept otherwise genuinely forward-looking ideas from taking shape. So I think there's this, at least initially, I go on to move beyond this kind of reversal of the Cold War binary in the book, but at least initially, it's a way to begin the conversation. Perhaps our Cold War ideologies fail to describe even what we thought we were up to.
Interesting. And so it was a matter of, I think you write in the book, it said, you know, the United States knew the how, but did not know the why for creating the internet.
Right.
When they created it. In the case of the Soviets, they knew the why, they just couldn't get the how done.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an interesting way of putting it.
So by that I mean one of the key things that we celebrate about the ARPANET and the internet ever since is the how. It's the protocol, the TCP/IP protocol. That basically we developed this way of allowing any node to connect to any other node and to share in distributed random walk pathways across diverse distributed networks of nodes. And this allows for a robust, survivable, and always unfolding
and completely decentralized
system. Completely decentralized.
At least that wouldn't go well over in the Russians.
Right. And that's one of the things we love about this how, right, is that it's got this kind of political impetus, this imagination of true distributed power. But I argue one of the things that America hasn't had, to its benefit and not, and the global internet ever since, is a clear justification of why we're making this network anyway. It was initially thought with kind of modest ambitions. We're going to create email. We're going to let scientists exchange research.
Scientists exchange research, have high-level discussions, not about the Kardashians.
Not about the hacking.
Right, no, right, none of that stuff. Right. So the why, I mean, the commercial implications were totally barren in our effort.
Initially, right?
But the Soviets did have a why. It was about creating this sort of, again, a socialistic utopia.
Yeah.
Where everybody was connected.
That's right. If you're looking for bold political imagination, there's no better place to look than early Soviet computer scientists and their theorists. Just grand and almost, you know, Napoleonic at times, ambitions about what a computer network could do. Here are a few of the surprising kind of technical innovations that I stumbled upon in my research. An early Soviet version of cloud computing, or what we might call rather less PR-friendly today, remote surveillance networking. Mm-hmm. A version of online banking or an electronic currency system. A paperless office ready for both businessman and bureaucrat. Natural language programming that wouldn't use syntax but rather semantics. So like a computer program that could tell that the chair sits on the ceiling is nonsense. All the way up to really ambitious ideas such as mind uploading, which they called information immortality.
Wow.
This idea that you could take your neural network and its patterns and upload it onto some live computer memory network and thus allow your consciousness to live on. But not only the individual, the Soviets broadened it to the collective, that whole societies and groups and maybe even someday a full nation could go online.
Now, let me ask you, did they think of that in terms of idealistic sort of expressions or more of a control of citizenry? For example, you said like, you know, cloud computing where, okay, mm-hmm. you have a remote place to have computing, but I as Big Brother can always look at, see what you're thinking and what you're doing. Or online banking, on your economics, how are you making your money, how are you doing this, that sort of thing. Was it geared towards a surveillance approach, or was it geared towards this sort of utopia?
A great question. And the answer is,
probably
as it always is in Russia, multiple times, depending on who's talking. For the state and the power elite, the obvious incentive, as it is today, and this has nothing to do with socialism or capitalism, is to control your users. Right? That's true whether you're Google or the NSA or the Soviet OGOS or the Central Committee. And for the theorists, however, there is much more, I think, sophisticated version of give and take and interaction, an idea that's probably closer, more faithful to the initial socialist mission, that any user could upload information about the workplace or the home place and try to make improvements on the fly. Something that we've seen succeed in other business environments elsewhere.
Tell us a little bit about the story. They had the knowledge base to create something like this, but they just could never get it going.
Yeah.
And one of the stories of the book is how the bureaucracy affected that. And I imagine with the Soviet bureaucracy, it's immense.
Yeah.
And you refer to it as OGOS, but if we translate that, it's basically the all-state automated system.
Thank you.
And so was it supposed to basically control all interactions with the state and the citizens or among citizens themselves? What was it designed to do? Really?
Right. So the all-state automated system, or the OGOS, in Russian, that's the Obshchoye Государственное Автоматизированное Система Управления, and that's the short version. The full version goes on for another 22 words, was a very ambitious and often sometimes vague project. So it scaled down to as little as, it could be as little as this, a hierarchical technical network of computers that would allow for information exchange between factories to regional, at the lowest level, 200,000 factories at one moment, to 20,000 like prominent regional computer centers, all the way up to one centralized computer processing and economic planning center in Moscow or near Moscow. That would be its technical skeleton that would allow for flows of information up and down the pyramid network, but would also, importantly, for the decentralized approach, allow for users to communicate across factories and laterally across the silos so that one did not need to always go through Moscow.
Now, was this a sort of reaction to all the consumer shortages that we associate with the Soviet era, where people standing in line for hours for whatever is available at the local department store? Was this a thought as a sort of a way to alleviate some of that thing?
In fact, that's precisely right. The Soviet bureaucracy went through a treadmill of reforms trying to respond to that precise question. The lines are so long, how do we, supply better? And it tried every trick under the book. There's been, five ministries to as many as 27 ministries, all expanding and contracting to try to fit different needs in different ways. And that kind of institutional unease and tumult ensured that it was very hard to figure out how to design a network to map onto that institutional structure, because the institution itself is always changing. I use the words not hierarchy but heterarchy to describe the heart of the Soviet bureaucracy. We think of the political structure as hierarchical, perhaps, but the bureaucratic structure that was actually processing the commands was itself subject to internal conflict of the extraordinary nature, one that we actually see very much alive today. If you want to think about Russian hackers, it's probably best not to think about a cabal of super sleek five people at the top of Putin's right hand, but instead to be thinking about a messy group of conflicting, partially compromised, always changing environments of groups and conflicting agencies that are talking over each other and never having enough resources to do so. And that story is actually one that dates back far longer to not just the Soviet era, but probably back to Ivan the Terrible in some ways.
Basically a series of apparatchiks trying to curry favor with the ruler, whether it be a czar or the chairman of the Communist Party or the president of Russia,
right,
and trying to think of things that will curry that favor and using the apparatuses of government to do that.
To do that, and never having the stable civil institutions that one needs to go about actually serving the people.
Yeah. One of the things you write is, one of the things we always need to remember that science and technology does not need democracy, freedom, or other liberal values to flourish. And this is the Soviet internet failed for its reasons, not because they didn't have our values.
Right.
I mean, if you throw out all that bureaucracy They could have created the same sort of internet we were looking at.
Yeah. On their own terms, there's nothing about the social values that mm-hmm. either promises or, you know, forecloses against technological innovation. And so a philosopher and anthropologist by the name of Bruno Latour once quipped that technology is society made durable, by which he meant that there is a connection between technology and social values, that Google search organizes its searches by what it calls a kind of democratic ranking, right, that votes for a search engine, votes for a page are democratically constructed. So there's social value there. I think the point of the Soviet internet story is actually to reverse that aphorism and to show that so too is society technology made temporary, which means that we've had computer networks now for 60, 70 years, 50, 60 years, and that across and what I think we're beginning to see in an emerging history of comparative networks is across the world, we've seen a wide variety of social values that have driven those computer networks. Sometimes they've succeeded, such as the brief Chilean CyberSyn computer network under Salvador Allende in the mm-hmm. early 1970s. Sometimes they haven't succeeded, such as the OGAS project or the French Minitel or the Canadians. Everybody has their own version. And each time it's being organized by different social values. So I think the point is to help us back away from whatever our own perhaps unthought commitments to the internet may be, and to recognize that in the future our social values will pass into the dustbin of history, but the computer networks may remain, right? And it's time for us to start normalizing and working within that constraint and to stop trying to force our own political or social agenda onto whatever we see the tools at present to be.
Yeah, and they are just tools, aren't they?
Yeah, they are tools. I think my favorite quote about tools is that they are neither positive nor negative nor least of all neutral, which means that they're always doing stuff, but they're not they have effects. They really matter. They really transform the world. But they rarely do so in ways that we can anticipate. So if nothing else, this story is a call for us to brush up on our media literacy and to reassess the possibilities of the past when thinking about the possibilities of the future.
All right. Ben Peters, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Benjamin Peters is an assistant professor of communications at the University of Tulsa and a member of the Information Society Project at Yale University and author of How Not to Network a Nation, The Uneasy History of the Soviet Internet. It's published by MIT Press. Professor Peters will be participating in a lecture and book launch later this spring at the University of Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.